Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sally Booker, Executive Director with Africa Action, who discusses the humanitarian crisis in the Darfur region of Sudan and the urgent need for international intervention. Amira Woods, co-director of the group Foreign Policy in Focus, who assesses the U.S. transfer of power to an interim Iraqi government and the staggering costs of the war thus far. And Samer Rabadi of Amnesty International, who examines recent Supreme Court decisions on the rights of detainees in U.S. custody and explains why his group is calling for a special counsel to investigate torture allegations. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The 15th International AIDS Conference will be held from July 11 to the 16th in Bangkok, Thailand. What's different this year, however, is that some U.S. scientists will be barred from attending this major conference. According to Reuters Health News, California Democrat Henry Waxman stated he has a letter which demonstrates that the Health and Human Services Department has imposed new limits on who may speak to the World Health Organization. Waxman wrote a letter to HHS Secretary Tommy Thompson saying this new policy is unprecedented. Now, the WHO is required to ask the Health and Human Services Department for permission to speak to scientists, and only HHS may choose who will respond. Waxman declared that this policy is a raw attempt to exert political control over scientists and scientific evidence in the area of international health. And he continued, the administration will be able to refuse to provide any experts whenever it wishes to stall international progress on controversial topics. The upcoming AIDS conference in Thailand is considered the premier meeting for AIDS experts, but 40 presentations scheduled for the conference were withdrawn after HHS decided that only 50 U.S. scientists could attend. In light of the scientific community's outrage at this action, Waxman has asked Tommy Thompson to reconsider his decision on the Bangkok conference. The Guardian newspaper reports that 29 Italian police officers, including the nation's anti-terror chief, are on trial for fabricating evidence to justify a violent raid 3 years ago against activists at the Genoa Social Forum. On the evening of July 21, 2001, after a series of street battles with anti-globalization protesters at the G8 summit, police, prison guards, and paramilitaries stormed the protest headquarters in the Diaz School in Genoa and began hitting people, some of whom were in sleeping bags. Initially, the police claimed they had found two Molotov cocktails at the headquarters of the Social Forum. But prosecutors later admitted that the firebombs were planted by police, including Rome's deputy police commissioner. 62 activists were badly injured and taken to a hospital. 3 were beaten into a coma. One of those assaulted by police, Richard Moth, a London social worker, recalled screaming in pain as nurses held him down while a doctor stitched his wounds without anesthetic. Yet none of the attacking security officers have been charged, since they were all masked and could not be identified. Now, the unit commanders are on trial for failing to prevent violence, and several top police officials, including Francesco Gradatori, a head of the anti-terror police, are accused of defamation or making false statements to incriminate the protesters. In the summer of 2002, in the midst of big wildfires in the western United States, the Biscuit Fire in Oregon and Northern California charred 500,000 acres of national forest and wilderness. It took 4 months and over 7,000 firefighters to get the blaze under control. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the Biscuit area, also known as the Klamath Siskiyou Wildlands, has won the attention of the World Conservation Union, which has labeled the forest an area of global botanical significance with 131 unique plants. The Bush administration and its timber industry allies are eager to log the fire-damaged trees before they rot and lose their commercial value. 2 years ago, Bush used the burnt trees of the Biscuit Fire to promote his Healthy Forest initiative that would increase brush thinning and tree cutting on 20 million acres of federal land. Many environmentalists have denounced the plan. As Joseph Vail of the Oregon-based Klamath Siskiyou Wildland Center observed, by far the least expensive option for taxpayers is to let the Biscuit area recover on its own. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
A humanitarian crisis is ongoing in Darfur, the western region of Sudan, where over the past year, at least 10,000 black Muslim Sudanese have been killed by Arab Muslim Sudanese militias with the tacit support of the Arab central government in Khartoum. In addition, 1 million residents of Darfur have been displaced, ethnically cleansed, with 120,000 of them fleeing to refugee camps in neighboring Chad. Aid groups say 1 million or more people from the Darfur region are at risk of dying from starvation and disease if nothing is done. The conflict has historical roots, but escalated in 2003 when two rebel groups in Darfur demanded an end to chronic economic marginalization and sought power sharing within the Arab-ruled Sudanese state. The U.S. Congress recently authorized additional funds to aid in the relief effort, and at the end of June, both United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan and U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell traveled to Darfur to assess the situation. On June 23rd, the Congressional Black Caucus endorsed a petition drive initiated by the group Africa Action that calls on the U.S. government to define the events in Darfur as genocide and to intervene militarily to stop the killing and displacement. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sally Booker, executive director of Africa Action, about the role the U.S. could play in providing humanitarian relief in Sudan, the dangers that poses, and why, as the world was remembering the 10th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide last April, the U.N. has been so slow to intervene in this current crisis.
The question is, can U.S. power be put to good use in the world today? Can it be used to save lives and stop a genocide, as in the case of Sudan, compared to being used unilaterally for regime change to bring destruction to countries on false premises, etc. So certainly there's great reticence to advocate U.S. intervention given the history of U.S. interventions around the world. At the same time, when you look at what's happening in Sudan and you recognize it's a genocide and you recognize all of these countries have an obligation to stop it, then you look at, well, who has the assets, who has the resources that could most quickly be summoned to put a stop to this while the United Nations pulls together a formal blue-helmeted UN peacekeeping operation, which generally speaking takes several months to both pass the resolutions and assemble the forces based on countries contributing.
And that's why you're not directing this to the UN in the first place?
That's why we're not directing it to the UN, because also the UN is only as strong and as proactive as its membership, and particularly the permanent members of the Security Council. And the problem right now is the UN Security Council has hesitated on Darfur, largely because of the economic and diplomatic interests of the permanent members, whether it's China or France or Britain, et cetera. They all have economic interests, including oil interests, in Sudan, and have been reluctant to antagonize the government in Khartoum for fear of losing oil contracts. So what we feel as strongly is what's needed now is a military intervention to stop the killings, provide security so that a program of humanitarian assistance can be mounted to the displaced, to the refugees, to the million people who are internally displaced, and the 2 million people who are going to be facing famine and death by disease if there's not an adequate humanitarian response in the coming weeks. And thirdly, to enforce the ceasefire, in fact, that the African Union had negotiated back in April. So this is a short-term mission. And what we're saying is the United States government has 2,000 troops in nearby Djibouti in East Africa. And they wouldn't even need to deploy that number. They would only need to deploy a few hundred troops to play the lead role in a multinational force. We would never advocate that this be a U.S. unilateral intervention, but that African countries, particularly those in the region, would be willing to contribute troops to a U.S.-led intervention with this very brief mandate to immediately go to Darfur, stop the fighting, allow humanitarian assistance in, and allow the UN time to put together a formal Blue Helmet UN peacekeeping operation.
In fact, are there African countries that have expressed a willingness to work in this kind of collaboration, or you just hope they will?
No, they have already, and this was also the case last year when the crisis broke out in Liberia and West African troops were prepared to participate in an intervention there and requested U.S. leadership. The U.S., of course, declined, causing delays, causing loss of hundreds of lives in Liberia, and ultimately it was the Nigerians and other West Africans who took on the sole responsibility for the intervention in Liberia. In the case of Sudan, the African Union actually provided leadership in negotiating the ceasefire between the government and rebel groups in Darfur, and they have put together a truce observer mission. They already have a small team of 10 people in Darfur that arrived at the beginning of this month, and they're supposed to deploy a total number of some 120 observers, but they don't have a mandate to do anything other than observe and report on violations of the ceasefire, and they're not even yet operational. So what it represents is, on the one hand, African leadership to try and end this conflict. On the other hand, the lack of capacity on the part of the AU to do what's absolutely needed at this moment.
What do you think is the level of knowledge or awareness in the U.S. about this crisis?
I think the American media is beginning to focus on the crisis in Darfur. You know, this has been a lead story elsewhere in the world, you know, for several months now, and the United States is just now beginning to give it a bit of focus. And it's a critical issue. This is the 10th anniversary of genocide in Rwanda. All the governments around the world and politicians have been saying never again, as they said after Cambodia, as they said after the Holocaust. And yet they continue to dance around the issue and avoid calling this a genocide. So that's why we feel it's so urgent to call for this kind of intervention, and also to begin to really critically look at what is the appropriate use of American power in the 21st century, and can citizens of this country demand that their government put this power to use in the interest of defending human rights and human life.
That was Sully Booker of Africa Action. To get more information or to sign the group's petition, call them at area code 202-546-7961 or visit the group's website at www.africaaction.org. 2 days ahead of schedule, U.S. authorities in Baghdad handed over power to an appointed interim Iraqi government on June 28th. The symbolic transfer of authority took place in virtual secrecy in a move designed to evade an expected wave of violence by insurgents bent on disrupting the original handover date. Saddam Hussein was placed in the custody of the new government, but will still be guarded by foreign soldiers. Questions remain about how much real power the new government will be able to exercise on major policy questions and its authority over the 138,000 U.S. troops and other forces which remain in the country. Iraqis are widely skeptical about the legitimacy of the new government led by Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, a man who was on the CIA payroll for many years. A June survey conducted by a British polling firm found that 60% of Iraqis think the U.S. invasion of their country was wrong, not surprising given the chaos and violence which continue to consume Iraq 15 months after the Bush administration's preemptive strike. The Institute for Policy Studies, along with Foreign Policy in Focus, have recently published a study on the cost of the Iraq War, both human and economic, incurred by the people of Iraq, the U.S., and the world. The study, titled Paying the Price, the Mounting Costs of the Iraq War, provides a comprehensive analysis of civilian and military deaths, reconstruction costs, and the resulting cuts to social programs in America's domestic budget. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Amira Woods, co-director of the group Foreign Policy in Focus, who assesses the U.S. transfer of power and the staggering costs of the war thus far.
We continually refer to this as the so-called transition. We see it really at the Institute for Policy Studies and Foreign Policy in Focus as a transition in name only. Yet again, the Bush administration is after form and not substance. The so-called transition happened 2 days early, primarily because the risks have continued to mount in terms of the security situation in Iraq. And that is because this war was based on really nothing but lies and deception from the very start. And again, you know, history has proven us right that, you know, the weapons of mass destruction that were to have been in Iraq and to have posed a danger to America and the global community, those weapons of mass destruction have never been found. That was the first lie. The second lie was the link of Iraq to al-Qaeda. Yet again, we see from the 9/11 Commission that this too was in fact untrue. And the Bush administration has continued to really put forward lie after lie, creating a situation that has really escalated out of control. And what you have today is essentially a so-called transition to a governing party, a governing body that is unknown, they're unpopular, they are primarily, you know, exiles with ties to the CIA, also the British intelligence forces, and with very little credibility or trust among Iraqis themselves.
Amira Woods, tell us about your report. Summarize, if you would, the report titled Paying the Price, the Mounting Cost of the Iraq War, and the costs to the U.S., coalition partners, and the Iraqis in human and economic terms.
The report came about really because of our belief that for democracy to exist, you need informed debate. And so what we have done at the Institute for Policy Studies and Foreign Policy in Focus is to gather all the facts we could in terms of the costs of this war to the U.S., to Iraqis, and to the world. And we find that the costs are really higher than anyone, particularly here in the U.S., imagined. I think it is really well known that roughly 950 U.S. soldiers have been killed. But what is not well known is that 10 times that number of Iraqis have died as a result of this war. So it is not only the mounting economic cost of $151 billion in an age of deficit here in the U.S. and the trade-offs that that brings, but it's also looking at the impact of this war on human lives, on families, on communities, and on international conventions and norms. This bill so far, $151 billion, could also have paid here in the United States for health care, for example, for uninsured Americans. 27 million Americans could be insured for that same amount of money spent on this really ill-conceived war based on lies. Also, you could have had salaries for school teachers. 3 million school teachers could have been employed with this $151 billion being spent unnecessarily in Iraq. And if you boil this all down to each individual American, you realize that the long-term cost of this war, if you average it out over a three-year period of war and occupation, would cost each American household $3,415 of their hard-earned money.
You've compiled in this report the economic and human costs of the war, but what about the intangible costs for the United States in terms of the nation's reputation when it comes to how the United States is perceived by people all over the world?
Without a doubt, I think this is perhaps the greatest cost to U.S. and the world. One of the items cited in the report is a quote from the International Institute for Strategic Studies, which is a London-based think tank, which says that the effect on al-Qaeda of this war has been, and I quote, accelerated recruitment. So not only have you created an unbearable burden for American families, but you've created an environment where the world is even more unsafe.
That was Amira Woods, co-director of the group Foreign Policy in Focus. Read their report, Paying the Price, the Mounting Costs of the Iraq War, online at www.ips-dc.org or contact their office at area code 202-234-9382.
After years of legal challenges to the Bush administration's policy of holding persons it declared enemy combatants indefinitely without due process, the U.S. Supreme Court has issued two rulings in related cases. The court affirmed the legal rights of both U.S. and foreign citizens to challenge their detention before a judge or other neutral decision makers. The decision rejected arguments made by the White House that the president should retain unchecked power to hold prisoners without charge and without access to the courts. The cases were filed on behalf of a U.S. citizen and 16 foreign-born men seized in Afghanistan during the U.S. invasion there in 2001 and 2002. In another area, Amnesty International has called for the immediate appointment of a special counsel to investigate claims that detainees held in U.S. prisons in Iraq, Afghanistan, Cuba, and other secret facilities have been subjected to torture and inhumane treatment. The human rights group says that current probes of the abuse are compromised due to the possible complicity of high government officials in authorizing torture techniques. Documents leaked in the aftermath of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal provide evidence that Bush administration officials wrote legal opinions asserting that the president was not restricted by U.S. and international law prohibiting torture. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Samer Rabadi, deputy director of Amnesty International's Western Regional Office, who examines the recent Supreme Court decisions on the rights of detainees and explains why his group is calling for a special counsel to investigate torture allegations.
Supreme Court basically affirms that no state can arbitrarily deprive a person of liberty and that every person has the right to judicial review. Amnesty International welcomes that decision and believes it is important that individuals have the right to an attorney to be able to challenge their detention in court. Otherwise, those individuals are lost and are in limbo and are behind this invisible wall that anything can happen to them and there's no way to find out and there's no way to challenge.
Is there any darker side to this decision? You know, sometimes these things are mixed bags. Anything that concerns you?
They basically still allow for the detention of someone without charge. While the individuals have the right to a judicial review, they can still be detained for a period of time while that process takes place. There's no innocent until proven guilty here.
I'd like to move on to another area that Amnesty's been quite active in, and that is Amnesty International has called for the appointment of a special counsel to investigate the acts of torture carried out against detainees in U.S. prisons in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the U.S. naval base in Cuba, and maybe some other secret locations. Tell us about this.
Sure. It's always Amnesty's policy to call for an impartial and independent investigation anytime there's alleged abuse of torture of any kind. And so in this particular case, I mean, we obviously have evidence that's very well documented, both in the photographs and the recent memos, that there's a fairly widespread incidence of torture, no matter what the administration wants to call it. According to the international instruments, the Torture Convention, some of the others, the definitions are fairly clear, and the people who created those documents, you know, wanted to create a definition of torture that was as wide and broad as possible in order to keep governments and states and actors from trying to find loopholes. And that's basically what the U.S. administration has been trying to do over the past couple and a half years, is to find workarounds, loopholes to get around things like the Geneva Conventions, the Torture Convention. For us, and for, you know, international law, the international community, there really is only one standard, and that is torture is absolutely against the law, period, no exceptions.
Is Amnesty International looking to investigate high Bush administration officials, some of whom signed opinions legitimizing forms of abuse?
We've never in the past ever approved of any kind of impunity where a person, no matter how high they are in the government, is allowed to escape whatever justice comes their way in regards to abuses of human rights. We've never said, oh, because this person is the president, or because this person is a minister, or because this person is a secretary at a certain level, that somehow they can escape from the consequences of these kinds of actions. So, you know, no matter how high this may go, I mean, that person is responsible. If there's proof of it and they get due process, then it should go as high as it can.
In your view, what is the role of U.S. citizens at a time of crisis such as we're facing now when it comes to human rights, when it comes to lack of due process for foreign citizens and U.S. citizens, and the idea that our Bill of Rights is breaking down right before our very eyes? What are the things that Amnesty International is advocating citizens do in a moment of crisis like this?
It's very reasonable to be concerned with national security. A terrible thing happened on September 11th. It was a terrible, terrible thing. And it's very understandable and reasonable to want to be concerned with safety, with security. And Amnesty endorses that. Every country has the right to protect its borders. Every country has the right to be concerned with national security. It's when that concern treads into the abhorrent that we say you have to stop. Torture, holding people for years on end, this is inappropriate behavior. And the way to think about it is just to think that, okay, what if this was a U.S. soldier? What if this was a U.S. citizen being held under these conditions? What kind of outrage would we feel? What kind of outrage would we feel if it was your neighbor or a friend or that went off in the military and, you know, was in some foreign country and was held in these conditions? It's that kind of thinking that we need to get people to start doing, that it's a standing up for, yes, we want to be safe, yes, we want to be secure, but these are things that we refuse to do. These are things that demean us as people. These are things that are immoral and unlawful. And so we ask people to hold by those principles that exist to civilize us, that exist to keep us safe, too, because what these actions of the administration has done is it's made us less safe. Even the administration admits this. There are more terror acts since they've instituted the war on terror than before. And so we ask people to stand up for their human rights and to defend their own rights and to defend those of others around the world as well.
That was Samer Rabadi, Deputy Director of Amnesty International's Western Regional Office. Contact the group by calling 1-800-AMNESTY or visit their website at www.amnestyusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Zelfia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.